Welcome to the newest edition of Sea Control, your moment of PowerPoint rehab from the Center for International Maritime Security. As always, I am your semi-useful host, Director of Online Content at SimSec, Matthew Hippel. Now for this week's podcast, we will be discussing China, Hong Kong, and Taiwan. World observers have been watching with rapt anticipation the democracy protests in Hong Kong for the past several weeks. And recently, in a surprise move, President Ma Ying-jeou of Taiwan, whose strategy has been a noted management of antagonism with the mainland, has come out with a statement openly supporting the Hong Kong protesters and the idea of democracy and a one country, one system ideal, with a bias towards democracy and reform. This all comes before a summit between American President Barack Obama and Chinese President Xi Jinping. Dean Chang joins us to discuss all these factors, as well as some discussion of Prime Minister Modi's visit to the United States and the dynamic that India may play within this relationship. That and more after this short break.
Do you like the Sea Control podcast? Sure, we all do. However, we're only a small sea in the ocean of content available to you, our dear listener, at the SimSec website. Sign up for a membership at www.cimsec.org/about/membership. China may have a 9-dash line, but our seas are clear, and we welcome your opinions and articles. Please take a moment while downloading this podcast to leave us a 5-star rating and a comment. We need them. Seriously, how do you think we pay this electric bill? Money?
And welcome back to another edition of Sea Control, your moment of PowerPoint rehab from the Center for International Maritime Security. And we are joined again by the oh wise and wonderful Dean Chang to discuss China, Hong Kong, and Taiwan today. And Dean, you've been on the show before, but before we get started, for any new listeners, fingers crossed that I have those, just what's your background, where are you coming from, and kind of how are you coming at this problem?
Let's see. Well, I am the Senior Research Fellow for Chinese Political and Security Affairs at the Heritage Foundation. Been there for 5 years now. And before that was with the Center for Naval Analysis and SAIC Corporation, which I guess sort of shows I have trouble holding down a job. Have been looking at Chinese security issues for most of that time. We do try to exploit Chinese language materials as much as possible because it turns out the Chinese actually write a great deal, but they don't always translate it. And to be fair to them, it's not unreasonable for them to say, look, you can't expect us to have to translate it for you as well.
That's fair. Maybe they also have a problem because I tried to take one class of Chinese, and by that I'm in Rosetta Stone before taking the class, and I was like, no. This is not happening. I had a buddy who did it, and I had a life. He did not. So I feel like I won out in that equation. But so today we wanted to talk about some interesting developments. We've all seen the Hong Kong protests and the issues with China, the mainland's refusal to implement the universal suffrage. But what's particularly interesting, I mean, China being brutal and putting down protests is not really a new thing, although in Hong Kong it's unfortunately a little bit more new, is that Taiwan, President Ma Ying-jeou has waded into this debate, and he's said that he stands for, he stands with the Hong Kong protesters, and I thought a particularly powerful statement that he said was, one country, one system is sort of like a hint to the Chinese that sure, we're all about being part of China, but not until we see a system that works. And I guess I'll just open the floor to you sort of wax poetic, as it were, about how you view this. Because President Ma has been very understated. It seems like he's been about enforcing the status quo, and that's his way of ensuring the safety of Taiwan. This is a very bold statement on his part, I would say. And let's just get your thoughts on that.
Well, we got to roll the clock back a little bit. So let's begin with the issue of Hong Kong, which triggered all of this. So the issue here is that when Hong Kong was going to revert from British control to Chinese control, the Brits basically said, oh, and by the way, you need to treat them as a democracy. And not surprisingly, the Chinese sort of looked at them and said, wow, you ran this place for 150 years and you never held free elections. In fact, you held no elections at all. But now that you're handing it back, we're supposed to hold elections. Huh. So there's a little bit of hypocrisy there on the part of the British leaving this situation. And it was left up in the air because it wasn't very clear exactly how these elections were supposed to be run. And this brings us to the second problem, which is that this controversy has been, in a way, very much under legal auspices, which is to say, the Chinese basically said, all right, look, we signed an agreement that would allow for universal suffrage. And the Chinese have obeyed. The Chinese have complied with this. What wasn't made clear, and once again we go back to the Brits sort of leaving all of this up in the air, was who would you then cast votes for? So the Chinese attitude is, we are going to allow universal suffrage. We're just going to make very clear who you can cast a vote for. We are going to determine the slate. Which, like a good contract, the Chinese basically picked and chose their grounds, and they've got a leg to stand on. Now, this is where the protests came in, because, let's be blunt, the Chinese are not complying to the spirit of the law, even as they are certainly obeying the letter of the law. And that's where you had the protests, and this was then exacerbated when the head of Hong Kong, C.Y. Leung, sent the Hong Kong police in with tear gas and pepper spray and batons the very first weekend, because he wanted to break up the protests before the work week began. So that sort of set the stage. And here we are 3 weeks later, and the good news is nobody's died. There have been some people who've gotten beaten up. It looks like the Hong Kong / Beijing authorities brought in some outsiders, possibly criminal gangs, to break up at least one or two of the camps. But nobody's died. We didn't get a replay of Tiananmen, which was 25 years ago. I think everybody wanted to avoid doing a replay. The bad news is the number of protesters is dropping. The folks in Hong Kong never really had the complete support of the population, particularly the businessmen who had already figured out how to work with the authorities, both in Hong Kong and Beijing, never really supported full democratization. So that's where Ma Ying-jeou comes in. So Ma has now, as you said, for the last 6 years of his term and a half, he has taken a very low profile. But in the past couple of weeks, he's now really shown a new face. One is on the issue of Hong Kong, where he has come out in favor of democracy. And the reality is that China's handling of the Hong Kong crisis has been abysmal. If Hong Kong was supposed to be the paragon of one country, two systems, the dangle to the people of Taiwan saying, look, we can do this with you guys too, you'll be left alone. The June white paper that Beijing put out, which basically said one country, two systems means most importantly, one country, you obey, pretty much killed any real prospect of Taiwan finding this appealing. So to some extent, I think President Ma is acting on that. The other thing that he's done, though, is that he has also come out and said, I think we understand what the nine-dash line is. This pertains to South China Sea. And it does not apply to the waters of the region. It applies to the land territory there, islands, reefs, spits, all that sort of thing. And that contradicts how Beijing has been acting. Not necessarily what Beijing has been saying, because every time you ask Beijing, what does that nine-dash line mean, they sort of mumble into their sleeves, and it's like, we'll get back to you. And now Ma has put a mark on the wall for that as well. So I would say that right now, there are a lot of people in Beijing who are rather unhappy with President Ma.
What do you think the impact of that's going to be, both with the mainland liaison office has already rebuked Taiwan for its quote-unquote irresponsible comments, And there's the reaction with China, and there's the reaction with the domestic population. So if you could maybe talk a little bit about how, and you know what, there's a third party here. Will his words have an effect on the protesters in Hong Kong, do you think?
Well, the protesters in Hong Kong, as I said, their numbers are shrinking. It's been 3 weeks. The broader population really hasn't mobilized in support. Probably one of the most depressing things has been the reaction from the mainland, where, okay, Beijing, not surprisingly, activated the Great Firewall of China. Internet information has, you know, radically dropped. But among people who have been interviewed, at least, it seems like there's not much support for the Hong Kong protests, which to some extent you can sort of understand, because they at least get to vote for a slate that is approved by Beijing, whereas in China, they don't get to do even that. So you can sort of see how people in China might be like, what are you complaining about?
Right.
But with the drop in the number of protesters, for a while it looked like Hong Kong's leadership might take a hard line that might bring more protesters out again. Now it looks like that's not going to happen. So really it depends on whether or not there's something that will spark a significant number of people to come back out again. And I think, again, the Hong Kong leadership is trying very hard not to provide some kind of trigger that would get more people back out in the streets. President Ma's comments might inspire that, but I think it really comes down to what happens in Hong Kong. In terms of Beijing, I think that they are going to be looking at this and wondering where this is going. Ma has basically 2 years left in his term, and in 2016, then, we are going to see, I would predict, a significant ratcheting up in tension. The Chinese reaction to Hong Kong means that the people of Taiwan, I think, are much more unified these days in how they look at Beijing, which is to say, you know, we didn't really trust you before, but we might have been able to paper something over, but you've pretty much made very clear that you're not going to abide by one country, two systems, with your most important, most successful financial center. If you're not going to do it with Hong Kong, why should we believe you with regards to us in Taiwan? So I think that you're going to go into the 2016 elections in Taiwan with a population that in many ways is more unified than it has been over the last 8 to maybe even 16 years over how the island as a whole thinks about China. Doesn't mean that everybody is necessarily going to be pro-independence now. That's not what I'm saying. But I think everyone is going to be very, very skeptical of Beijing's intentions and is really going to be rethinking, okay, if that's true, what does the future hold for this island nation that diplomatically is not recognized by too many people? The scary part here is that, so we go into 2016 with Taiwan in ferment. So there's a real possibility here that the DPP, the Democratic Progressive Party, the more overtly pro-independence party, may well win. And let me note here that this is not a matter of personal preference or anything like that. But it is instead...
As you are a registered Taiwanese voter.
No, but the reality is that when you have 8 years, two terms of one party, the pendulum tends to swing. Mm-hmm. And so I, you know, if I were a betting person, you know, I would be saying that I think the odds are pretty good that the other party is going to come to power. And that applies over there, as well as over here, or in Great Britain, or anyplace else. So that's one piece. But the other thing here is going back to actually the United States. In 2016, we're going to be in an election year. Mm-hmm. And we don't tend to vote on foreign policy. It's hard enough to get people to pay attention to foreign policy when things are happening. You know, China has been relatively quiet compared to, say, Ukraine, or compared to Ebola, or compared to ISIS. So you've got a situation where we could find ourselves in 2016 with a changed dynamic in Taiwan, an American political system that is paying attention to anything but the Far East, and a Chinese leadership that on the one hand is ticked off at Taiwan for a variety of reasons, and Xi Jinping wasn't in power the last time there was a DPP president under Chen Shui-bian. That was under Hu Jintao. So in a sense, you have a relatively new Chinese government that is going to be trying to figure out how it wants to deal with this situation. And by the way, their economy may be slowing down. So there's going to be all sorts of internal pressures on Xi. So I guess what I'm getting at is 2016 could be a really scary year in the Taiwan Straits.
So before we slowly shift over to the inevitable gravity of talking about China it all by itself, we've all seen the pictures of the dwindling protests in Hong Kong. Is the end state that this just goes away? I mean, it seems more organized as time goes on, that, you know, they're building little tent cities, etc., etc. But as the numbers dwindle to a certain point, they'll just, a few cops could come by and just arrest a lot of them, depending on how many are left. Is really that what that the government is waiting to happen, for everyone to just go home?
That's certainly what Beijing is hoping for, and I suspect that that's what Hong Kong's leadership is expecting. The lack of a trigger to bring more people out into the street means, as you said, you know, a dwindling number of people. It is harder and harder then to keep the news cameras around waiting for something to happen. The other thing is that when you decided to camp out in Central, in downtown Hong Kong, it was a great move from a media perspective, but you were going to alienate the local businessmen, mm-hmm. the local restaurant guys, the guys who are, you know, running the little shops and things, because nobody was going to go there. And I think the protesters picked a good week to start. They picked National Day, October 1st. So it was a holiday. It was the middle of the week. To some extent, you were limiting the amount of inconvenience. But as time has gone on and you're supposed to get back to the work week, you know, they made a good strategic decision not to try and take any government buildings. Because if they had done that, I think they would have, you know, the Hong Kong authorities, backed by Beijing, would have sent in whatever force necessary to clear them out. And I think, again, everybody wanted to avoid bloodshed, wanted to avoid actual casualties. But the flip side to that is, as a result, you don't have something to rally people around. The bureaucrats, the businessmen, they go to work, you know, and that suggests a less than effective set of protests. So, you know, at the end of the day, yeah, I think that China, I mean, I would say Xi Jinping has come out of this probably the biggest winner. It was his first crisis. It was the first problem that arose in his, since he took office in 2012, which came from outside, where he could not simply say, okay, I'm going to dial it up or I'm going to dial it down. The bad news is for Xi Jinping, because he won, he's alienated Taiwan. So this is one of those, you know, at the end
damned
of the day.
Damned if you do, damned if you don't.
Yeah. There's no good answer. Same is true for the students. They are damned if they, you know, if they had tried to take over things. But by not doing that, they are evaporating in terms of public visibility. It's not to say the people of Hong Kong, the broader population, doesn't support them. But at the end of the day, how do you show that? Especially when the businessmen and a lot of the other vested interests, they're happy with the way the system has been set up.
Something that's coming up that this may be a bit of a, and you know what, it may not be a wrench in the works, but come November, President Obama and President Xi Jinping are going to have a summit as part of, to coincide along with the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation meeting. How do you think these events, the events in Hong Kong, the recent statements by Taiwan, how will that change this dynamic?
I don't think it's going to actually change the dynamic very much at all, because I think that to change the dynamic implies that there is a dynamic. Look, we had the Sunnyland Summit between Xi and Obama, which, if you believe the White House press releases, was the most important meeting since the last meeting between Xi and Obama. But in reality, Xi Jinping refused to even stay at Rancho Mirage because that summit occurred right about the time that Snowden left for Hong Kong. And the Chinese were quite upfront in saying, we do not believe that we can have electronic security at Rancho Mirage. So that's why we're going to stay at the Hyatt downtown. I think it was the Hyatt. They stayed at a commercial hotel. The point being that that whole summit was intended to be a shirt sleeve, informal opportunity for these two leaders to get to know each other. And the Chinese pretty much slapped President Obama in the face. That should give you an idea of just how warm or not warm relations are.
Not warm, maybe a little heated.
Maybe heated, but also frosty. So that's the thing. So what's going to happen here? At the APEC summit, I think what you're going to see is the Chinese are going to run through the litany. They're basically going to say, don't sell arms to Taiwan. And President Ma has just come out again saying what it is that he would like the U.S. to sell to Taiwan. Stop conducting reconnaissance operations off our shores. And just in case you didn't get that message, they might even do another barrel roll around a P-8 again. Huh. And, cancel all of these FY2000 National Defense Authorization Act restrictions and the annual report on China's military, because that creates a bad environment. So we have heard this for the last 14 years from the Chinese. You know, every time we have meetings, that's what happens, is they lecture us on this. Plus, more recently, they've added in, oh, and by the way, this whole Asia pivot thing is why there's tensions in the region, because you are egging on, you are stoking tensions. President Obama is, I think, going to respond by saying, stop conducting cyber espionage. That's kind of hard to argue when you have Snowden still making revelations. Stop pushing the neighbors in terms of your air defense identification zone over the Senkakus and the South China Sea, respect human rights, etc. You know, what you're doing in Hong Kong, we're not really happy with that. So what's going to happen? The two sides are going to basically nod, smile, shake hands for the cameras, and go away thinking the other person is an obvious twit. Sorry, but that's my upbeat assessment for the upcoming APEC sidebars between President Obama and Chinese President Xi.
And as the gravity inevitably shifts, as I said, to China, as our kind of last question here, recently Modi kind of exploded onto the scene in New York, and some consider India to be our sort of counterplayer to China, not Japan, not these other Southeast Asian powers. I mean, to a point, yes. But this really big player on the block that may seek to compete with China. It has nothing to do with Taiwan or Hong Kong, but, I mean, we're here anyway, so why not? Let's bring it up. How do you think that relationship will develop, and do you see that maybe affecting this upcoming summit at all? As the Chinese go, maybe this relationship we don't want to happen might be coming into being.
Well, first off, I think that it's remarkable that we would try to balance a major power we barely understand by aligning with a major power we don't understand at all. So we have a fair shortage of China expertise in this country. People who speak the language, people who read the material, people who are interested in it, etc. We have a lot more China experts than we do India experts. What in the world makes us think that we can play India as a card? I mean, India is a large country with a long history, and they have their own interests. Sometimes those interests may align with the United States, and they will cooperate with us. A lot of times those interests will be independent, not at odds, just different. But the idea that India is going to sort of sign up to say, yes, join us, we'll join you, better yet, we'll join you in countering China. Where does that idea come from? Never mind.
Hope.
Which is not a strategy. It's
true,
a great
fair.
Idea, but it's not a strategy. You know, and people complain about American arrogance. This is it in spades. I mean, you know, this idea of, and by the way, how much traction is that going to have if and when the American economy is actually eclipsed by the Chinese? You can get pretty far when you're the number one economy. You get a lot less far if you're the number two economy. So we should probably start rethinking exactly how we want to approach other countries about this. Now, that's the first one. But you're right. Modi exploded on the scene, in part because of the Indian-U.S. summit, in part because that came right on the heels of the India-China summit. And that was marred by the fact that the Chinese sent 1,000 troops over the border into India. Now, that should scare the living bejesus out of us, because it suggests an attitude towards how you deal with a fellow nuclear-armed country that is radically different than how we think about it. You know, people often say, you know, nuclear weapons ensure that, you know, nuclear-armed states don't go to war with each other. Well, that's true in Europe. You know, we backed off, they backed off, post-Cuban Missile Crisis, you know, we never wanted to waltz up to the abyss and look in as closely ever again. But with the Chinese, in 1969, they sent troops into the Soviet Union. They fought a bloody series of border battles. You know, that was not something that we saw in Europe or, you know, around the Arctic Circle. Sending troops into India to reinforce the idea that China claims huge tracts of Indian territory should worry us, because that's the sort of thing that suggests a willingness to play by very different rules when it comes to a crisis. Now, the fact that this happened literally on the eve of a summit should worry us as well, because it raises questions about what is going on, what are the Chinese thinking. But it's also part of a pattern, because when Premier Li Keqiang went to India a couple of years ago, about a year plus ago, Chinese troops also went over the border into India. In fact, in about the same area. So you start thinking that maybe there's a pattern here. It's sort of like when American secretaries of defense go to China, the Chinese unveil another fighter plane. My own personal recommendation is we should stop having SecDefs go to China, because I'm not sure how many more fighter planes we want to see the Chinese rolling out.
But I don't think they're Schrodinger's cat. I don't think that's how they work.
You sure? Okay.
As long as we don't go to China, the fighter planes may not exist.
you might be right about that. But the thing here is that we have a pattern of behavior here that I don't think we understand very well. And so to assume that we can pull India in as a strategic ally or partner, because the other piece to this is that up there in the Himalayas is a three-way fight. It is India, Pakistan, and China, where Pakistan and China are closely aligned, if not outright aligned. So that further complicates all of the calculations.
And I think there we go. That is our week download on China goodness. It's a Wednesday night for those who want to know Dean Chang's great charity at 9 o'clock at night. Is there anything recently that you've been reading that you've been following in regards to China that you think that to get a scope on the current crisis or on where it might be going, you think people should read or look into?
I think that it's always a good idea to read up a little bit about the history. So since we've been talking about Hong Kong, there are a couple of good histories out there on the Opium War. And it's probably worth, you know, for those who are interested in the subject, because the Opium War was the initiation of the so-called Century of Humiliation, to read about it a little bit, to understand that from the Chinese perspective, you know, all of these sorts of issues goes back to the idea of being respected and not being pushed around. And the object lesson from their own history was, when you are weak, when you are allowing others to push you around, you get exploited to the hilt. So I think the Chinese are very serious when they say, we're not going to go through this again.
And for more excellent learning on China, everyone should read The Road to Khartoum. It starts in China. It's General Charles China Gordon. It's a book about him. And it's quite excellent. It has nothing to do with Hong Kong, but it's rip-roaring, insane adventure. So I'll just throw that out there. Again, Dean, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.